quick rehearsal for tomorrow's Mass. The Ita Missa Est. So if, actually, Father, if you want to take over.
Tomorrow for the Solemnity of St. John the Baptist, the deacon has prepared the Ita Missa Est, but the one that he selected is, it's in the Liber's Wallis, but it's not in the Bride of Water Romanum that you have. It's also not in the Parish Book of Chants. So we're going to practice, I'll sing it to you, and then we'll practice singing it. It's a little bit long. It sounds like this. Ite Missa Est. Your part sounds like Deo. Sing Ita Missa Est, you sing Deo Gratias. Ite Missa Est. Just read the gracias.
Gracias.
Thank you very much. Tomorrow, the liturgy will be the ordinary form in Latin. Maybe tonight, before you go to bed, just review the prayers, the responses. Review saying the suscipiat after the orate quadris. And we were asking also. We're going to write out the musical notation for the deacon to chant the gospel tomorrow. Would anyone have music notation paper, be it the 4-line or 5-line? Anyone have a sheet of paper in the back? I'll come see you right now. Thank you very much.
In this time, I'm going to spend the bulk of my talk talking about some of the new resources that are online. In my own parish, we've had quite a lot of experience with them, and I've been doing some workshops, and both Arlene and I have been doing workshops experimenting with some of these resources. You can see the sheet right here. We're living in a remarkable age, and sometimes, I forget now what literary philosopher it was that said the signs of your times are sometimes invisible to you. You know, I feel like it's that way for us. We've been through 2,000 years of sacred music only in the last several. Have we seen this extraordinary outpouring of infinitely reproducible digital editions that are available to all of us? And I believe that it's transforming the nature of Catholic music, and it presents an amazing opportunity for us in this room and for everybody who cares about beauty in the liturgy. But before I do that, I just want to say a few words about the book, which is actually, it's called Sing Like a Catholic, and it was published only about 2 months ago for purposes of raising money for this event, because as we had many people writing us anxious to come to the colloquium and didn't have financial resources anywhere near to make it possible. And every year we try to kind of cobble together a small fund for scholarship money, and well, you know, given the recession or the depression or the meltdown or whatever you want to call it, things have been a little bit short in that area. So we had to come up with a new way, and this seemed viable, and it turned out it did actually work. I mean, many of you are here with the assistance that some of this book elicited from willing consumers. So it was good. I was very pleased by it. But there are a couple of chapters in the book that I'm particularly pleased with. The one is on the open source musical culture, and that's going to be the bulk of my talk. The other chapter in there that I was pleased with, because I happened to spend a lot of research time on it, and it wasn't like most of my writing sort of, you know, done in a hurry, very quickly on a blog or something. It's the chapter on Israeli Hebrew and Latin chant. And the title of the book actually comes from research I did for that chapter, but I never explained in the book how it is that I came up with that title, so I'd like to tell you about that now. And it was a very interesting thing. On the plane, coming from Alabama, I was sitting next to a gentleman who was typing away on his computer, and like a jerk, I was looking at his screen, right? And which is the most annoying thing that people do to me, but I do it to others. And I couldn't understand anything he was typing. It just looked like I couldn't make any sense of it. So at some point, and don't you hate it when people start striking up big conversations with you on an airplane? Well, I did that. I said, I'm so sorry, sir, but can you tell me what language are you typing in? And he turned to me and he said, well, it's Hebrew. He's writing in Hebrew on this computer. So I said, well, do you have a Hebrew keyboard? He said, well, sure. And he showed it to me. So it was marvelous. I looked down and I realized he was about, I would estimate his age is something like between 60 and 65. And I thought, my goodness, I just happened to be sitting next to a person who's very likely one of this rare generation that was raised in the first generation of Jews in Israel who for whom the Hebrew became their vernacular. And so I asked him, I said, so where were you raised? He said, well, in Israel. So this is it. This is great. So this is a case study for me. So we did have a wonderful conversation throughout the whole thing. And he was surprised that I knew so much about the subject. And I asked him, by the way, why is it that there were so few English, well, so few resources, the way I put it, being a typical English speaking guy, I said, how come there's so few resources on how it is that Hebrew became the vernacular in Israel? I had looked very hard and only found snippets and small chapters here and there. And he looked at me with sort of a confusion. He said, well, they're all in Hebrew. What was I thinking? Of course they're all in Hebrew. So, I mean, typical Americans, right? We just think that if it's not in English and, you know, you can't buy it from Amazon, you know, it doesn't exist. No knowledge is not printed in English, right? So I began to check some of my facts with him. So the story goes like this. And in the 19th century, Jews were scattered all over the world, of course. United States and Russia and Poland and Germany. And they were developed among a very small set of people. Concern over the loss that was coming about as a result of acculturation of the Jewish people into their respective cultures. And this acculturation was in many ways a wonderful thing, but it also had a cost, and the cost was the loss of Jewish identity, and with the loss of that identity comes the loss of faith. And a very small set of people thought or dreamed up this idea that the best way to sort of recollect the Jews together as a people and bring a coherent sense of identity of who they are as a way of preserving their identity and their faith was by, and this is a ridiculously implausible idea, actually, if you think about it, we will just have all Jews in the world learn to speak Hebrew. Absurd. Only a crazy person would come up with that idea. And his name was Eliezer ben Yudana, and his article appeared in 1879. It was called The Burning Question. And he proposed this idea of making Hebrew again a vernacular. Very implausible, because for about 1500 years, Hebrew had been mostly the language of scholars and poets, and had not been a vernacular at all. And 19th century language theory had developed the view that it would be impossible to actually impose a language on a people. It's one of those organic institutions that has to arise from within a culture, that language comes about through use, not through imposition. So it was said to be an impossible task that he faced, and he was dismissed. But our friend Ben Yudana was not deterred by the laughter, and but instead began to write a dictionary and a thesaurus of the Hebrew language, which you can still get today. It's still in print. I just looked on Amazon today. It's like $5 or something. It's a huge thing. And he put the whole dictionary and thesaurus together, and people began to realize he was very serious. Of course, there was also, as you probably are aware, a political motivation here, too. And the movement was the political movement of Zionism, and the idea was to establish the state of Israel as well. But for our purposes, the purposes of Catholics, we're looking at this as a kind of a model of what is possible. The political element here is not really relevant. So language scholars dismissed it, and other Jews completely dismissed it. His strategy was interesting because as a language that was mostly poetic and mostly rabbinic, you had really two separate vocabularies and two kinds of usages that were extant in the world. He cobbled them both together and came up with a compromise between the two and wrote this dictionary and suggested everybody use it. And it turned out the movement did take hold a little bit at a time. It began with the moving back of Jews to Israel, and as they would settle, the small group of Zionists would persuade one family at a time, you know, we really should be speaking Hebrew as a way of giving ourselves a richer sense of identity of who we are. And the families that were convinced of this might be living apart, but then they would move together and speak Hebrew as a vernacular amongst themselves. And then they would invite more families, and it became very sort of hip and popular, the thing to do, and more people, and it spread out, and then it became a civic language once the community got big enough to have something like a civic association. Then they would speak it in civil discourse about how they would live. Well, so it started very small, very grassroots, and only through persuasion, you know, a little bit at a time. And it gradually got larger and larger until about the 1930s, when it seemed to be almost a foregone conclusion that it was going to happen, that Hebrew would become the new vernacular of the Jews living in Israel. And yet, I found resources that were dating from the early 1940s where people were continuing to completely dismiss it, the prospect that this would ever happen. Well, by 1948, you know, Hebrew had become the language of the Jewish people and the language of Israel as a vernacular. I don't mean just an affectation, but a real language of daily communication. And so the gentleman I was sitting next to in the airplane had been the first generation in, 1,500 years that had been raised from an infant to speak Hebrew as his first language. And that's who I happened to be sitting next to in the plane. So I asked him a critical question. And I had read this in several sources, but I couldn't verify it well enough to put it in the book. But one of the means of discipline that they used was when a new immigrant would come in from Poland or Germany or Russia or the United States and would be speaking Polish or Russian or German or Yiddish or some other local language that they came in with, the existing Hebrew speakers would hear that and go up to them and tap them on the shoulder, could be a complete stranger, and say, speak like a Jew. Speak like a Jew. And they would change. And there was a way that they enforced discipline. And I asked him, is it true? He said, sure. That was the theme. You would hear it every day. Speak like a Jew. And he said that, in fact, this was the way that people were encouraged to remember who they were and what they were doing. So that's where the title "Sing Like a Catholic" comes from, because we do face something like an analogous problem in some respects, I think. Mostly, I think the analogy is important because people say that the task we face is implausible, it's impossible. You hear this all the time. Well, whenever they did speak Latin, I don't know, but you know, it's no longer our language. I don't understand the words, and when I go to Mass, I want to understand what I'm saying. Okay, so you hear this all the time. This is a preposterous undertaking you're doing, trying to push a Latin as a language. You understand that our task is not nearly as difficult. You know, we're not seeking to encourage people to use Latin as vernacular. You know, that's not anywhere near that. I mean, that's not anything that's even on the map. We're just talking about a language of liturgy. a much more limited vocabulary that's fixed and has a very deep tradition. This is all we're speaking out of here. And I think it's an important analogy for us to remember that if a certain people have a goal and feel enough burning passion about it, I like the title of Ben Yuna's first article, A Burning Question, okay? If you have a burning passion for it, it can be done. And we have the model right there before us. When the Jews did it, they had no prior model. It was really the first time in the history of humanity that a whole people like that recaptured a language that had been lost for so long. Our task before us is much more modest by comparison. So I like to look at this as an example of for inspiration of what can be done. And I don't think there's any doubt of the reasons for doing this. I mean, I remember long before I ever got involved in the Gregorian chant movement at any level, I was in Rome, and I think it was Regina Caeli, and it was being sung outside. It was an outdoor mass, and most of the Asian peoples, you know, were able to sing this and sang it very well. You know, half the Europeans could. None of the Americans could sing Regina Caeli. Never even heard this song. They're kind of looking around and go, what is this weird thing going on here? You know, this is some strange language they speak in Rome. It's not for me. So, as Catholics, we need to understand that there is a grave danger to not having a universal language of liturgy, something that we have in common throughout the whole world. Especially it was funny, the Jewish man sitting next to me in the airplane, he said, I asked him, I said, do you think of any other advantages to this? The fact that you and all the other Jews in the world that you know of can share in common this language? He said, well, it's really great because if anybody intercepts my email, I know they'll never be able to read it. You know, so it's like their secret text they can communicate with each other. Well, you know, Catholics also need something like this. In any case, you see the analogy, and I think it's an important one, and an inspiring one. Okay, now let me go on to this question of open sourcing. By open source, I used the word the other night, and some people gave knowing looks like, oh, you know exactly what I'm referring to. What I'm referring to is the fact that the text of the liturgy and our music really constitutes a non-scarce good. I gave a lecture on economics last week. I introduced the lecture by pointing out that God has given us in this world two kinds of goods, scarce goods and non-scarce goods. Only scarce goods are subject to economic considerations. You have to have the property, you have to have exchange, you have to have prices, you have to have some way to allocate them and divide them up. Most everything you can think of in the physical world is a scarce good. But there are these non-scarce goods, and there aren't too many of them, the main one of which I just identified as ideas. Ideas are not scarce. They're potentially infinitely reproducible. And through digital media, the non-scarce goods are, in fact, through the medium of the internet, they take on this quality of being infinitely reproducible. What that means is that the original owner has the original good that he writes or possesses, but then copies of that can be made infinitely on an ever-increasing level, you know, till the end of time, and it doesn't diminish the integrity of the original product. So you see what I mean? This is what I mean by an infinite reproducible good. And in some way, we might think of it as like analogous to God's grace, so that it continues to multiply and multiply, and to anybody who reaches out to it in some way, it's always there. So there's a sense in which I think non-scarce goods, ideas, share some qualities with the divine. And the text of liturgy, in fact, is one of these non-scarce goods that's infinitely reproducible. And through digital media, we're discovering this. I'm not entirely sure it was obvious to the scribes, the monks, that for all those years before the age of the printing press, devoted their entire lives to copying, you know, manuscripts. This is what they did. What took them 50 years now takes us, you know, 3 seconds. Extraordinary to think about, right? So this is what people devoted their lives to doing. And now we just rush off at a break and, you know, pull out our iPhones and do this same darn thing, you know. But it's because of the technology we're now realizing that there's a special quality to the liturgical text, or to text in general, namely that it's not scarce. You know, I think the same thing applies to music in general. It was so interesting to me because I was trying to think of examples of the way in which composers have borrowed and copied melodies from each other in all genres. And this Vaughan Williams piece we sang this morning, right? It ends with, "Oh God, our help in ages past," which is a piece that was written in 1719 before the age of copyright. And I leaned over to Dr. Martin and I said, "Well, it's a good thing that piece wasn't under copyright. He'd still be paying royalties, you know, for the thing." But it's a wonderful thing to borrow and imitate and copy. This is the way music has evolved systematically, one generation learning from another. And there was a time when it was considered very flattering, really, to take a melody that somebody else had written and write an elaboration on it. And you can think of many examples of this. I recall that when I lived and breathed the world of jazz music, you know, when I was in early college years, one of the things that jazz musicians do is they quote from each other, and it's considered to be very flattering, you know, a way of paying homage to somebody else and showing how much you appreciate what they do. And this way of copying others and imitating others becomes a great source of life and growth in the art itself. Well, you know, the culture of copyright has changed this in a very strange way. Now somebody copies a song or a melody or something, well, you know, look at you, you've infringed on my intellectual property. You know, it's a completely different culture that's developed. And you understand that this is a very new thing. This is a very modern thing. International copyright law only became an institution with any kind of worldwide applicability starting in the late 19th century. I don't know when the Berne Convention was, 1890, something like that. Before then, as long as something crossed the border, even under the most restrictive copyright regimes, if something crossed the border, then it was completely free. This is one of the reasons Americans love British literature, because in the 19th century, British authors would face a very strict copyright regime in their own country, in exchange for which they got sort of these pathetic little royalties, from which they never made any money at all. But their big money came from selling the first run rights to American publishers who could publish the same text in public domain. So the first person who published, the first institution that published the text was able to charge a very high price for it, and they would get all these monopoly profits from the first publication, but instantly it was available to everybody else, and other publishers would get into the action within a matter of months. Really, the price would be driven down to virtually zero, and then all the public schools could afford it. And so the British literature was much cheaper than American literature. So it was pervasive throughout the United States and became very important for teaching. And then the author became very famous. So when it came time for him to write his next book, you know, what would happen? He could charge an even higher price to the institution that wanted to run it first. And the authors made far more money by selling under a public domain intellectual property regime in the United States than they ever did in Britain. Isn't that interesting? In any case, come the 20th century, everything's changed. And we have a completely different culture about these subjects. And I think it's negatively affected, my own view is that it's negatively affected the arts in general. But in particular, it's had a strange impact on liturgical music. One of the great tragedies, really, is that the ritual text itself, and I don't mean a particular tune, but the text of the Mass itself, has come to be enslaved in a strange way, or encaged in this copyright problem. And I'll get to that a little bit. The Church Music Association of America has long had an interest in freeing these texts and making them, again, public domain, and having them take on their natural quality of the divine, that infinite reproducible quality, rather than being artificially restricted by use of legislation, which is really what's going on. You know, when ritual texts are copyrighted, it's like using the state to artificially restrict something that really should be a public good. Monsignor Schuller wrote many wonderful, very intense articles on this topic throughout the 1950s and the 1960s because he saw this happening. And he singled out ritual texts in particular. And they had to be available to musicians or else their musical creativity is going to be seriously hindered. Father Skerritz, as recently as the spring 2003 issue of Sacred Music, he has an interesting article on church music in which he argues that church music has a different character than music for the world. And he points out that even the law has long recognized an exception in copyright for the performance in a liturgical setting. He cited a 1976 law. I think that has since been reversed, but I hadn't looked it up yet. And he writes, inherent in all liturgical activities is the dimension of a public good. I think it's a very beautiful thing. Now, by the grace of God, the law has been cooperating with the desire to free the liturgical texts for all Catholics around the world. And it goes something like this. In the United States, until... the law is too complicated to, and it's irrelevant anyway. The point is that anything published before 1964 had to be renewed after 28 years or it enters into the public domain. If it enters into the public domain, it can never again be lawfully, privatized again or made a proprietary text. So think about the dates. Anything before 1964. Now, it turns out that most of the publishers of the great music of the 1950s and 1940s and 1930s did not renew their copyrights. And certainly anything in the 1950s, I mean, most publishers that would publish this stuff have either gone defunct by the time the renewal dates came up, or, it wasn't the thing for them. This is an amazing thing for us, because what it means is these texts have become part of the commons of Catholic life. Anything after 1964, though, is largely proprietary and still trapped in this artificial world of scarcity and physical editions. And the people who hold these kinds of goods look at the internet and digital media as a great threat to their well-being, and I think they're right to do so. Really, the revolution all began, I think it was about 3 years ago, when several of us began to look into the whole question of the Salem copyrights. It's very dangerous for me to get on this topic. I think we'll be here till midnight. So it turned out, and you know, I was talking to a chance scholar in Britain, and I said, well, have you ever thought about just writing your own editions of such and such chant and sending me a copy on an email? He said, no, you can't do that, because of course the epizema and the ictus and the epizema and the ictus. Is there anything else upstairs? No, I think it's mainly that. So maybe there's the salicus, I don't know. Are copyrighted. And I said, wait a minute. The ictus, that little tick thing, a little tiny mark. Somebody's copyrighted, how's that possible? Well, and the epizema, how do you copyright an epizema? This is crazy. It's true, it's absolutely true. Trust me. And he was terrified to write his own editions of chant. And the more I talked to people about this, it seemed like this is a universal thing. People were really afraid. And listen, church musicians are, what's our attitude towards copyright? We live in fear all the time, you know? We're always worried about this topic. It concerns us greatly, right? We don't want to do anything wrong, and we don't want to get in trouble, and we don't want to suddenly have, you know, our pastor presented with a lawsuit, you know, that's going to cost the parish $20,000, we'll get fired, or whatever, you know. So this is a big deal for us. Well, so I began to look into this whole issue, and I finally talked to an expert at the Library of Congress, and I asked her specifically, say I made a tiny little mark above a black dot. Can I copyright that? She just laughed at me and said, no, that's preposterous. You know, you can't copyright an ictus. That's the silliest thing I ever heard. And she thought, I was wasting her time for even asking such a question. And I felt like I had after, you know. So I called the guy and I said, look, I talked to the copyright division here. the ictus is not copyrighted. And he said, well, I really need to have proof of this. So, do you know where all this goes back to? Have you read some of the history of Salem? You know, it's quite an amazing thing. When you look back at the revival of chant, coming out of the Salem Monastery, there are lots of splits and arguments about rhythmic theory. And Poche and Makro, Poche went one way, Makro stayed at Salem, and they began to argue about which edition in particular was going to become the great Vatican Gradual of 1908. And the edition without the ictus was chosen. And almost as a retaliatory gesture, Salem, which was in many ways a modern institution, took advantage of modern copyright law. It was new, and copyrighted all their editions. And in particular, they pointed out that the difference between their editions and the Vatican edition was the presence of the ictus and the accusans. And that's it. That's how this pervasive wisdom came about. And they wouldn't let anybody else reprint it. My own personal perspective is that this is a terrible decision. So I'm sure they had no idea what the implications would be. Anyway, the long and short of it is that after all of these years, all of this music has entered into the public domain. And the Church Music Association of America was the first institution in the history of the world to, and I'm so pleased by this, to put online the full Gradivale Romano. It was funny because I began to get these strange phone calls, like anonymous phone calls and anonymous emails from sort of, you know, people who make me threatening. I never forwarded these to you, Dr. Martin. threatening us with you know, grave trouble. We're going to get into big trouble. Salem is feeling very litigious and all these kinds of things. Well, we had to be very careful about everything we did. Of course, it's absurd. Everything is online now. But now, listen, we still face, and I'm going to talk a little bit about some of these resources in a second. We're still facing problems with ISIL, as you know. ISIL continues to copyright the text of the Mass. Very recently, though, in response to a lot of the badgering we've been doing, they made an enormous concession and have permitted the free posting of the text online. Royalty free. So what that means is that we can make digital editions of any music that applies to the Catholic Mass and distribute it and pay nothing to anybody. We can give a free gift to the world. We can evangelize. You know, imagine that. I mean, this is, you know, somehow, you know, when I think about intellectual property, when I think about the gospel writers, can you imagine them copyrighting? You know, that's the opposite idea. You don't want to restrict, you want to open up, you want more, right? Teach all nations and all that sort of thing. And sometimes we have to remind ourselves of these things. So ISIL has made some concessions, and I think they're going to be willing to make more in the future. There are some battles that are going to be taking place, discussion. Over the next couple of years on this subject, especially with the new texts, which is very funny. You know that we've already have a great deal of ISIL music already written for the new texts, and you can get it delivered to your email. That whole email delivery, this is very interesting. We put it online first, all this music, and I got a call on my cell phone from, I have his number, he has mine, he calls me quite frequently, the guy from ISIL, and he says, look, you got to take this stuff down. You know, that can't stay. And, well, the compromise position is that we can distribute this stuff through email. That's why how it is that Aristotle Escobar came up with this brilliant system. You put in your email address, and, you know, we send you a zip file of about 60 pages of music. That's how come we have to. I mean, otherwise, you just link it, right? You just say, hey, here's the thing. No, we have to deliver it on email. This is the compromise from iPhone. Well, anyway, when the text comes out, we hope that we're going to make some progress. There is this, also the issue of the Grail Psalms, which I'd write in the book and everywhere. But we've also had some compromises in that front. They have agreed very recently, when the Conception Abbey first finished the Grail Psalms, they sold the international rights of the Psalms to GIA. And GIA itself, a private for-profit publisher, will have the proprietary the rights to administer this proprietary text to the whole world and decide, just completely on their own, what they want to charge people with the right to use the Psalms of David. So this is the absurd situation we're about to move into. And anyway, GIA has recently made a concession now that they too will allow for a complete free posting online, but not in print yet. So it's the print issue we need to get to next. Okay, now I'm going to finish up the talk by some discussion about the future. And if I can draw your attention now to this list, I came up with this list. People have been encouraging me to do this for some time. Now look, most of this stuff, and I don't want to go through all the details here, most of this material you understand is online just since we held this colloquium last year. Do you realize what kind of outpouring we're experiencing? This is like 12 months worth of material. This is the age we live in now. All of this stuff is now accessible to us. Composers are increasingly posting these things. Okay, let's start with the English copies. I'm just going to say a few words about what I consider the merits of each of these little items. 100% free, you can download them instantaneously, use them in your parishes, print them. You know, we have to get into this habit, you know, as Catholic musicians. It's going to take us a while to acculturate ourselves to the new environment. You can print them, you can distribute them, you can do, for that matter, you can sell them. I mean, anything you want to do with these great. The first thing is the American Gradual. I like this American Gradual. It has limitations. What this is by Bruce Ford. He's an excellent scholar of chant. People always say to you when you start singing Gregorian chant, well, I like chant, but I can't read this crazy notation. Everything in modern. So, well, okay. Bruce Ford is in modern notation, so we check that off. The second thing people always say is, why Latin? Why do I have to use Latin? Why not English? Okay, so this is also English, so you can check that. This is very, very nice, actually, for beginning scholas and also for workshops, because, you know, when you go into a workshop and start passing out this stuff, it's an unusual form of music to begin with. It's not metric, so they have a hard time adjusting to that. It's Gregorian chant, so it's modal. It's a difficult adjustment. You add to that Latin and also an unusual notation, it's a lot to take on. So, with the American Gradual, you can put the Latin on the shelf and put the notation on the shelf and say, let's just deal with what we have here. And it goes very fast. And you can get people absorbed into this world of chant very quickly. And the melodies themselves are drawn from real Gregorian melodies. The Gradual is a complete Gradual for the church here. And all the melodies are there's very little adaption that takes place. Most of the adaption of the melodies are done for what Bruce considers to be scholarly reasons. In any case, it's the real Gregorian melodies in English. I find them very effective, extremely powerful. We did them at a workshop a couple of weeks ago, and you know, after you finish, I had a group of about 40, 45 people, something like that. But after we finished singing the first time through, you know, we did it alternating high voices and low voices with a double bar, and at the end, you know, we finished the final Amen, Tutti, and the eyes were just like big. Like, what did we just do? That was amazing. And I said, what do you think about that? And a lady in the back said, it sounds like prayer. And everybody said, yeah, that's it. It was like prayer. Yeah, so this good stuff, very nice. The second thing here is the Richard Rice Simple Choral Gradual. I don't know if any of you have played with this little work of genius, but you know, Richard Rice wrote this material in the 1990s. It was at an ordinary foreign parish that needed something. And he's very convinced, Richard Rice, of course, is one of the geniuses of our age, but he was convinced that the music of the Roman Rite has to be the propers, and that hymns should not replace propers, that we should be singing the propers. So this choral gradual, what he did is he wrote easy four-part arrangements of all the propers for the ordinary form in English, and the parts themselves don't move more than two or three notes, you know, each individual part, but his harmonies are very rich and genius, and he chooses a kind of a different melodic structure for each one of the propers, and wrote it for the entire year. Well, let's say that he wrote it up to Corpus Christi, and as we approached Corpus Christi, I started getting tons of these emails in, where's the rest of the Rice Choral Gradual, where is it? And I began to send them on to Richard, and he's like, oh God, I really have to go back to that crazy project. But he did. He's very generous. And just 2 days ago, he posted the rest of the church year for us. So I haven't added the files together, but it's all there for you. And now, listen, we use these in Birmingham Birmingham, Alabama, for the bishop at a mass that our soul sang for. And you know, they're so dramatic. You know, it's an absolute time to hear the bell ring, and then the thing comes in. It's this big, big, rich choral sound, very clean English text. It's a short antiphon. It stops, and there's this silence that rings throughout the whole cathedral. And then you begin the psalms, and then you begin to. There's a big silence. You start the antiphon again. It's truly majestic. And the bishop came up to us afterwards and said, "What was that amazing entrance that you sang? Was that the entrance proper of the day?" I think it was. It wasn't. I said, "Yes, it is the entrance proper, and it's a choral graduate." He said, "Well, you know, I've never walked into Mass before feeling like I was a king." You know, he said he felt like a king walking in. You know, so yeah, that's. I say he was very complimentary. Okay, now let's move on to the triad that the choral graduate. Now you understand, of course, that all of these are, as Dr. Mark points out, this is not the paradigm. This is getting towards the paradigm. The English chant proper by Father Samuel Weber are also online. We sang them this morning in Mass, and listen to how wonderful this is. Aristotle Escuero made a recording of the introit, which he sent me an email. I sent it to Father Weber, and Father Weber listened to it and wrote back already. Is that great? What a marvelous age we live in. And he said that in his dreams, that's the way he imagined it would sound, but he'd never heard it like that. And he said, "What was that amazing solo that sang that?" He was so touched to the bottom of his heart. And for him, things like that, to know that his music is being used in a liturgical setting like what we had today, it's for him, it makes his whole life worth living. I mean, that's great. That's great. That's what a musician wants. Once again, posted completely for free. The English chant proper by Columba Kelly have an interesting history, you know, because he wrote those in the 1960s. Because it was true that Sacro Sanctum Concilium said that Gregorian chant should take proper place, but there was a pervasive view that there was a pervasive sense that English paupers were coming and that something had to be done to set them to chant melodies. He doesn't hold the view that Bruce Forde, that, you know, Bruce Forde just puts English text underneath the Gregorian chant melody. Columba, Father Kelly actually wrote completely new propers for the church here. And, well, it's kind of a sad thing, I think, that this generation worked so hard to write chant propers for the English Mass and that history completely overlooked them, you know, because 1970 or so came by after the new Mass was introduced. And there was no consciousness at all of this repertoire that was sitting there. And there it had sat for all these years until about 6 months ago when they all came online, and now they're all available to us again. And do you know why they were never published? Yeah, that sounds like a broken record. He was afraid of the copyright police all these years. And it was the work of the CMAA to get the text into the public domain for digital download that finally did it for him, and he began to upload them all. So we're great beneficiaries of work that he did 40 years ago. They're all there for us. The Avogast copies were another project that was written in 1964. In this effort to put the calendar he was writing for is the 62 calendar, of course. That's an interesting case because you notice the date, it's 1964, so those are technically under copyright. And I wrote and I wrote and I wrote and I wrote everybody I could possibly to try to find a plaintiff somewhere who might complain about the fact that it was online. Nobody ever popped up and said, "Hey, those are our propers, take them back." So even now, to this day, it still says, "Look, if these are your propers, you know, let us know and we'll take them right back." But they're there now. Unbelievable what you have to go through. The final resource is very nice thing. It's the Anglican Youth Gradual. It's actually a very dignified psalm tone settings and quite useful in pinch. And I think actually more than that. They're very useful for any ordinary form routinely. And you might say that, well, there's no scola. There's no parish that can't use them very quickly. Listen, also on the Psalms, we do have with us Jeffrey Ostrowski, who's with Corpus Watershed. He's behind the camera all the time, but you know, he this man, what he did for the Psalms in this country was extraordinary. And I think it was only about 18 months ago or so that he opened up Chabanel Psalms because he was sick of all the Psalms. And where you're right over there, Jeffrey. There you are. Yeah. Going to go down in history. He's pioneering a new way to distribute music and inspire composers. I mean, and he is in our midst. Let's just try to remember, you know, who he is for the future. When the history of our times are written, he's going to be featured very prominently. I'm quite certain of it. What he did is he opened up the site and he began to post some of his own songs. He said, look, why pay these other guys when you could just download this thing? They're very beautiful. And it caught on, and he began to get more and more composers began to send him songs. And, you know, this has a funny effect on artists. You know, when you see some other artists getting all this attention, you know, and everybody's singing your stuff, their stuff, and you think, well, my stuff's at least as good as that guy's stuff, you know. And so what happens, they all begin to send him, it's become, right, it's just like an avalanche of stuff every day, you can hardly keep up. And now, what I do when people send me things, I think, oh, what a burden, here I go, I have to, you know, take time off and upload it, and I complain. Jeffrey doesn't complain. He says, what a wonderful gift. This is so exciting. Isn't that a great attitude? You got a better attitude about the stuff that I do. It's just great. He considers every composition that comes into him to be a glorious gift to Chabanel Psalms and also to the world. And the traffic on that site is going through the roof. So it's just great. And so many wonderful things to choose from. We sang Arlene O'Jenner's Psalm just this morning, which again is a free download. And also, he helped pioneer, again, a breakthrough in the intellectual property area and convincing the NAB to let him post the complete Psalms online, the USCCB, I guess. Who owns proprietary control of these things? It's still very confusing. In any case, he broke through because when he first began to post them, he could only post antiphons. Now he can post the entire Psalm. So you see what's happening here. In the area of Latin, proper is really extraordinary for him. The Graduale Romanum now, I guess it was about 2 years ago we put up the first Graduale Romanum. Now we have many editions online, the 1961, the 1908 is up there for those people who just will not sing with the nectus on their chant. It's right there. Can't do that. It ruins everything. Yeah. And we even posted, purely for study purposes, the 1871 Ratisbon edition of the Graduale, which is a fascinating thing to look at, you know, and it's there just for study purposes. But it was interesting because the man who convinced me to put it up said, oh, don't you think that scholars would be interested in this? Shouldn't we do this? And I said, oh, okay. And as soon as we posted it, he started writing on his blog, you know, these properties really are very beautiful and very useful, really, in mass. Why can't we just, you know, they're there for a reason. Well, why don't we just start using them? You know, this is very funny. Dr. Mark called me up and said, I told you so. Okay, the Gregorian Missal. Now listen, this is a great breakthrough because you all know what the Gregorian Missal is. This is, for me, I think the Gregorian Missal is our secret weapon because for regular Catholics and regular parishes, everyday parishes that are dealing with the problem, the pervasive problem that our singers and our priests and our parish administrators don't know that there's music that's attached to the Roman Rite. They think that the job of a parish musician is just to pick hymns that they like every week and just do that. That's your job and nothing more. If you show them the Gregorian Missal, it has a transforming effect on their outlook towards what Catholic music is. I mean, it's like a jaw-dropping experience. You open it up and you think, there it is. But there's music that's actually embedded as part of the Mass, wedded to it, it's native to it. You didn't know that before. The Gregorian Missal is a wonderful way to show this. You don't have to say anything. Look at this. It has that effect on people. So it was a thrilling thing that we were able to put that thing online this year. That text is, in fact, proprietary. But look, I wrote this Slim Monastery. I said, hey, what do y'all think about this about the idea of putting the Gregorian Missal online? They wrote back, sounds great to us. What a change, huh? And 100 years? It's a glorious thing. That was on the 100th anniversary of, when did that go up? Yeah, the 100th anniversary of the Vatican Graduale. Suddenly, all the old battles are over, you know? Now it's all about spreading it far and wide. So the Gregorian Missal is online. Send that link to your parish priest. Send that to anybody who wonders what you're doing here. or wonders why you're such a fanatic over this topic, or how come you're not on board with, you know, a mainstream Catholic agenda that's getting increasingly tired, just send them that link. It's fully bookmarked. All of the music is there. This is the music of the Roman Rite. And it's all in, it's in English. The Latin, the chant, of course, is Latin. It has translations in English. And it has the full ordinary of the Mass. It's a beautiful thing. And it's easy to navigate. Liber Usualis, of course, is also online. The Chants of Rage is an interesting little find. It's funny to pass over to Liber Usualis. This thing, there was such controversy about that only 10 years ago when everybody thought that you get sent to Guantanamo Bay or something for making a photocopy, you know. That was the... Chants of Rage, we get strange resources sent to us. This is some simpler graduates that were put together by Dom Gajard in response to the problem that not everybody is capable of singing the gradual. They are difficult pieces, and when you go to extraordinary found masses around the country, you do find that, you know, it's a wonderful thing that people attempt to sing everything in the Liber Usualis, but if they're going to mess up anything, if there's going to be a meltdown during Mass, it's always the gradual. It's always the gradual. And these are much easier pieces. Now, Richard Rice wrote an alternative. We had enough copies that I thought in the back of the Chants of Rage, which is in the back of it, they're all gone. I think we're going to try to get some more in, maybe. If you want to come up to me and say you wanted a copy of it, we can probably arrange to have some delivered before the end of the week. Richard Rice wrote an alternative to that. It's simplified graduals and alleluias. What he did is he took the real gradual antiphons and the real alleluias and just simplified the verses that are associated with them, which retains more authenticity and eliminates the most difficult parts of those chants. So you should make use of those. And if you know musicians that are working in the extraordinary form that have difficulty with these chants, I mean, far better to use this Chants of Rage or the Richard Rice simpler alleluias and graduals rather than resorting to something like the Rossini Progress. This is what people do. They crash and burn on the real stuff, and then they resort to, well, I gotta go, I just gotta sing a psalm class. Yeah. Well, there's an in-between solution. That's what these two are. Liber Brevior is another interesting resource. That hasn't gotten much attention, actually, but it's all the propers of the church here. It's kind of like the preconciliar version of the Gregorian Missal. It also has English. Very nice. Richard Rice has also posted a complete offertory verses online for free. All of these are free online. What these are, the verses for the offertory, you spend a lot of time in school to learn the offertory antiphon, and it goes by too quickly, and you want another chance to sing it again. Okay, so here's the offertory verses in psalm tone, so you can add verses to it the same way you do with communion. So it's a nice, very nice resource. Just this morning, to show you, is it this morning? Either this morning or yesterday morning, time kind of runs in together at these things. Richard also sent me, and I hadn't even uploaded on Musica Sacra, some introits for the full church year, written for three treble voices, like SSA and SAA. So introits for the whole church year, for every Sunday of the church year, just for three high voices. Those, I don't know when he has time to do all this stuff. Isn't it amazing? And those are also completely available for free. Or in print, either way. And finally, we have all these curiales, and probably have a dozen different curiales, so both in English and Latin, online. So when people ask about, I'm looking for a decent song to use, please, you know, just send them over to our website. You know, there's so many. Okay, I'm just about out of time. Let me just close with some observations on the whole question of open source. I probably didn't convey it well to you. I wished I could find different words to say it, but you see, by using this open source model, what we have here, we have what I think is the original model by which Christianity itself is spread. You know, it's open source, it's evangelistic. And we use this divine properties that ideas and texts have, and use the new medium of digital delivery to achieve this kind of universal distribution. You know, what if the gospel writers had access to this kind of technology that we have today? all the scribes, as I mentioned earlier. So this is our model. It's an open source model. And it's a completely different model from that which has dominated Catholic church music distribution for a very long time. And it's changing the culture of Catholic church music. It's made us more open, evangelistic, and I think it's made us all much more hopeful for the future. It's inspired new creativity and composition as never before. And the universal distribution of it means that composers get to experience something of the satisfaction that comes with knowing that your artistic endeavors are going to be used and going to be appreciated, and that your talents are valued, and that you're truly serving the universal church. And I think if you're going to speculate about what the future is, you should think very seriously about the difference between this open source model that the Church Music Association of America has and others have, like the Chavanel Psalms and others, as versus what I consider to be an anachronistic, closed, and fundamentally statist kind of system of proprietary restrictions that so many other institutions are caught up in. And these closed source institutions are their very lifeblood. Do you see what I mean? Do you understand what it implies about the future? I think we have very good reason to be hopeful. Thank you very much.